This week on Lunchbox Envy, Napoleon used to carry some with him into battle.
Countries that eat more of it produce more Nobel Prize winners.
And the smell of it in a bookshop can boost sales of romance novels by 40%.
It's chocolate, baby. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie and I'm here with my QI elves, Jack and Manu. Hello, both of you.
Hiya, how you doing?
Hey.
Very excited. It's everyone's favourite food, right? Kind of. Like, I don't know that many people who don't like chocolate.
I wouldn't claim not to like it, but I do think it's overrated.
Can we get rid of him?
I will turn to the chocolate dessert last.
You've clearly never menstruated.
Yeah, well, I admit, to my shame.
Could we talk a bit about how chocolate is made? Because, guys, as it turns out, it does not flow down from the Aztec mountains in a nice little river, which is kind of what I thought.
So chocolate's actually incredibly processed food. When I was really into this, I couldn't believe how many steps there were in order to get it from the raw cacao pod to a chocolate bar that we would recognize. So to talk about chocolate, we need to talk about the cacao pod. So there's a tree, it's native to Mexico, and it grows these enormous pods. They come straight from the branch.
Right.
They're actually a fruit, which means that, believe it or not, your chocolate is a fruit product. It's a very processed one, but it does ultimately come from the cacao tree, which grows pods, which are fruit.
Is it like pizza in America and one of the 5 a day? Because that would be really helpful.
Sadly, no. Pods contain within them the cacao beans, and inside them, you've got the seeds. Mm-hmm. What you do is you extract these, you know, white pods, and then you mush them up a bit and you leave them to ferment for 5 days. So chocolate's a fermented food, much like kimchi, tea, wine, all sorts.
So good for my gut health. Perfect. So the pods are mushed up, fermented for 5 days.
Mm-hmm. And then they dry them.
It's really important to say that first initial stage, because the cacao tree is such a complicated fruit, that's all done by hand.
Right.
Which is why it's so tricky to make, so expensive to make. And it's also the supply chain is pretty messy because it all involves a lot of human labor for picking the individual seeds.
Yes, because I read that it's very hard to grow on a commercial scale. And so there are a lot of just barely beyond subsistence farmers and, you know, family small farms who are making chocolate and cacao pods for commercial sale. And weirdly, even though it's native to Mexico, 40% of it comes from the Ivory Coast in Africa.
Yeah,
and another 10% from Ghana.
After this process of fermentation and drying occurs, it's shipped over to often Western countries where it's processed into chocolate. So what they do is they separate the nibs, the cacao nibs from the husks, and then they grind that into a paste, and it looks kind of like syrupy and it smells like alcohol, which is why it's called chocolate liqueur.
Oh.
Which is pretty cool.
Not the chocolate liqueur that I used to drink in the pub in sixth form.
No, not that. I don't think you'd want to drink this one. In my head, it would be quite bitter still.
Yeah.
It's not alcoholic, but it does smell like alcohol. And then they separate the cocoa fat from the liqueur. So we save the cocoa fat. That's cocoa butter. That's really important. Yeah. And then it leaves you with cocoa powder.
That's pure cacao.
Yeah, that's pure cacao.
Without the butter.
So I think that's when it's been heated even more. And then, confusingly, you can mix that back into the liqueur. So you have this wet and dried version. You mix it back in. And that is where the chocolatey goodness comes from. So all your sugars, if you want to add milk powder, that goes in there as well.
And then, the cocoa butter, that gets added back in too to chocolate.
God, so it's a whole process,
it's so complicated. Yeah. It's mad.
Cacao trees are actually quite unproductive. So a tree will typically make 20 to 30 pods per year, which isn't very much.
No, I make 20 to 30 pods per year.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
It's such a brag.
Which means that you'll get roughly 1 to 1.5 kilos of finished chocolate per tree per year.
Mm. Oh, that's nothing.
Which, yeah.
Again, that's my personal quota for chocolate for
the
year.
A weekly allowance.
From one cocoa tree.
That also will depend on what kind of chocolate you're making, like how much cocoa goes into each bar. Because there are obviously different kinds of chocolate, like dark chocolate will have a higher cocoa powder percentage than milk chocolate. And then white chocolate, which, yeah, doesn't have any cocoa powder in it, but does have cocoa butter.
Okay.
One of the maddest things, depending on where in the world you live, Cadbury's might not be chocolate.
What? Explain.
So, different countries have different definitions of chocolate, which depends on the cocoa percentage in that chocolate. Ah. So, in the UK, chocolate has to be at least 20% cacao solids to be called chocolate.
Oh, really?
But in the EU, it's 25%.
Ah.
So, Cadbury's tends to be between 20 to 24% cacao solids. So, here, it's chocolate. In mainland Europe, it is not chocolate.
No way. So if I take my, I buy a chocolate bar from Cadbury's, I'm halfway through it on the ferry to France. By the time I land, it's no longer chocolate.
Yes.
Wow.
That is one of the reasons why Cadbury's is called Cadbury's Dairy Milk and not Cadbury's Chocolate Bar.
Oh, no. Because there is that.
It's mad because there is that nuance. So interesting.
They've taken it out, the branding.
I mean, it's very clever. And in the US, it's even less. It's just 10% cocoa solids.
Oh, no way.
Hershey's.
Classic.
11%. It's just chocolate in the US.
Just about.
Just about. And then in Germany, chocolate has to contain sugar for it to be chocolate.
Oh.
Wow.
So you can't. Oh, I read about this.
Yeah.
Didn't someone try and sell 100% cocoa chocolate?
Yeah. It was Ritter. They were like, no, this is not chocolate. There's no sugar in it. You can't. You have to rename it. So silly.
I can't imagine there must have been much uptake for the old no sugar chocolate, I've got to be honest.
I have a surprise for you. I managed to source a whole cacao pod and it's under the table. Should I bring it out?
No.
No, you haven't.
Always wanted to see one of these.
Prepare yourself.
Oh!
Look,
it's so cool.
A pod on the pod.
Wow. Wow, wow.
For the listeners, I would say it's roughly rugby ball shape and sized, but it's knobbly, like a warty, warty cucumber.
It looks like something out of like a Ridley Scott movie or The Last of Us. Like it looks like it's an alien thing.
Well,
oh
right?
My God. It's super heavy.
Hit you on the head. From a height, you'd be in trouble.
Okay, let's crack this one open.
Nice.
I'm going to use my serrated knife.
Wow.
Oh, it's so tough.
It's...
I have to do a lot of sawing.
Stabby? Oh! Wow!
So you can see this is the pod and these are the individual beans. And they're very slimy.
Yeah.
And they don't really smell or look like chocolate, to be honest.
No.
And there are what, 20 to 30 of them inside?
I mean, they are also quite pink, aren't they?
But yeah, this is how chocolate starts.
Well, now we've actually physically cracked into a cacao pod. Shall we crack into our first lunchbox? Let's open up our very first lunchbox of the day, and that is my old friend Jack.
So today I've brought you a Colombian dish of hot chocolate. It's known as Chocolate Santafereño.
Oh, sounds sexy.
I think this might be our first Colombian dish to hit the pod.
Really?
Congrats.
Cheers.
Thank you very much.
What do they say in Colombia?
Salud.
Salud.
This looks
What's in that, Jack? I feel like you've led me astray.
Oh, there's something floating in it.
There's something floating in it. Jack, I thought it was a hot chocolate. What have you fucking given me?
It is a hot chocolate, but in this particular part of Colombia, they eat their hot chocolate with cheese.
So which cheese is in that, please?
It's Baby Bell.
Oh, come on. No. I'm not wild about it. No, I've got to be honest.
It's the closest thing I could find to the hard, slightly salty white cheese that they have in Colombia and that they put in this dish. And nobody really knows why they do it. I think there's a theory that it's often served with cheesy cassava flatbread.
Ooh.
It was a bit of an experiment, this one.
It kind of tastes a bit like if you had made this chocolate with some different animal's milk, like a camel or a goat. Like it's just like a bit funky. It's growing. I've got to say, The first bit, I was just not ready for it. So I was a bit shocked. Mm.
Anyway, basically this represents Latin America and liquid chocolate. Mm. And the two go hand in hand thousands of years. So the Olmecs, they were around 1500 BC. So before the Romans, very old civilization. They had a word, cacawa. And this describes what we'd recognize it as hot chocolate. But without the sugar, without the dairy. They learned to chop these pods down from the cacao trees and ferment it and get what we would recognize as very, very dark bitter chocolate. Mm. But they only ever drank it as liquid. So it's kind of the equivalent to our coffee. They would drink it like coffee.
And it does have a bit of caffeine in it as well.
It does have a bit of caffeine, yeah. Mm. Anyway, it was very highly revered. The Olmecs then passed it on to the Mayans, who came after them about 1,000 years. And they then passed it on to the Aztecs, who were only defeated by the Spanish in, 1500. Mm. So it's had a long history. And all this time, it was being drunk rather than eaten. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the word evolved from cacawa to chocolatl.
Mm-hmm. Am I saying that right?
Which is the Aztec word, which is what the Spanish then encountered. It comes from the words meaning hot and water. And there's a theory that it only went from cacawa to the chocolatl in Spanish translations because they were a bit prudish about the word caca, which means poo.
Yeah.
And also is brown.
And is also brown. And often liquid.
Good observation, Rosie.
Anyway.
You can see how the two could get mixed up.
Interesting that Aztecs preferred it cold, where the Mayans drank it hot.
Oh.
Yeah. The Mayans actually exploited the fact that it was quite hard to grow in all of their empire. And so they would use the cacao pods as currency.
Oh, that's wow. So cool. Yeah.
And we actually have some surviving exchange rate info. So one cacao bean for a tomato.
Cool.
3 beans for a turkey egg. 100 beans for a turkey hen. Mm. 30 beans could buy a small rabbit. And 20 beans hired a porter for a day. So you could hire someone to clean your ziggurat or whatever.
Wow.
but it was literally treasure. The Spanish noticed that it was often worth more than gold, but certainly by weight. So around 1500, Europeans arrive on the scene. Not great for the Aztec Empire, but they discover chocolate for the first time. Mm. They see people drinking it. They see how heavily it's revered. And they variously thought it was A, for women, B, an aphrodisiac, either disgusting or delicious, depending on how your tastes were. And they did debate whether or not you could have it during Lent, whether it was decadent enough.
There's a really nice story told by Susan Benjamin, who's a confectionologist. There's a,
I want to be a confectionologist.
She's so cool. But she tells the story of Hernan Cortez, the Spanish colonist, meeting Montezuma, who is like one of the Aztec leaders. And basically this guy, Montezuma, apparently super, super hot, really fit, and is surrounded by lots of women. And like they think, oh, he must have loads of wives. And they're like, shit, how does he keep up with all of these women? And they see him drinking the cacao. Yeah. And they're like, it must be the chocolate. There is no other way that it's humanly possible for a man to please this many women.
Wow.
So then this like, yeah, the myth of chocolate and sexiness and aphrodisiacs starts
running.
Well, it's one of the places this came from. Interesting. One of the things I love so much about this story of how chocolate spread around the world is the Spanish monarchy tried to keep the chocolate drink to themselves for a while.
Really?
Apparently, because it was super tasty.
So what are you drinking? Nothing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't like it.
It's caca, guys.
And then through lots of marriages and like new family members, the chocolate drink started like leaking out and they were sharing it with other people. And yeah, other people got wind.
It was first sold in London in 1657. Samuel Pepys wrote about his morning chocolate. And for a while, chocolate houses were treated a bit like coffee houses. So people would go there in a way and they drink a stimulant and they discuss like the politics of the day. They were quite egalitarian in that respect. In fact, the notorious Garrick Club, you know, the place that only recently started letting women in.
My friend works there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do they know that it started out as the Cocoa Tree Chocolate House?
I did not know that.
Its original name. So for all of this history, chocolate has been a liquid drink. So picture coffee. And then in the 1840s, Joseph Fry of Fry's in Bristol comes up with the idea of a solid chocolate bar.
Bristol! Shout out the West Country!
So we do have the English to thank for solid chocolate.
One good thing we have done.
That's right. I'm very proud of that.
And then the Swiss came along a few decades later and they did improve things. So they invented milk chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was the Swiss chocolatier Daniel Peter added condensed milk developed by Henry Nestle.
Ah, Nestle.
It's, mm-hmm. It's all coming name. Together.
And then Rudolf Lindt, another household name, he added more cocoa butter to sort of improve the flavour. And another thing he did to improve the flavour was invented conching, which is kind of a sort of combination of shaving the cocoa nibs, heating them up, mixing them around, putting the fat back in. It's kind of basically when you picture the Lindt adverts, there's all that liquid chocolate flowing out. It's a kind of constant, it sometimes takes up to 5 days for the best stuff. Kind of just like mixing it all in and slightly heating it to get all the volatile compounds out and make it even tastier.
Wow. There's a lot of household names in chocolate that are so old now when you think about it. Like Lindt's still around, Nestle's still around. Mm-hmm. Like it's quite an interesting sort of tight-knit group, the chocolate houses. It feels like fashion houses. That's what it feels like. It feels like Gucci and Prada.
And interestingly, Fry's and Cadbury's, the two massive players in the 19th century and most of the 20th century, they were both born out of the temperance movement.
What? Really?
Yeah. So they were big, like, anti-alcohol pioneers. Mm-hmm. And Cadbury has, you know, have you ever been to Bourneville in the West Midlands?
Bourneville, a famous chocolate.
Yeah. But it's named after the town he made. Basically, he wanted to build a town for all of the factory workers. So he built Bourneville right next to the chocolate factory.
Right.
And he was very much like, they need health care and like nice places to walk and childcare. And he was quite a sort of progressive man.
But no alcohol.
But no alcohol.
Oh. Yeah. It's a classic case of you shouldn't drink, but you should eat this incredibly unhealthy and sugary thing instead. That maybe might make you feel better.
You got to have something.
Yeah.
So by the 1920s and 30s, in America and Europe, the chocolate bar was like exploding in popularity. Mm-hmm. A lot of the famous ones we recognize today, like Mars bars and Kit Kat, they were invented in the 30s. But interestingly, in World War II, one company was commissioned to make a chocolate bar that wasn't as delicious as possible. This was the Hershey's D-ration.
Ooh.
So during World War II, the US military commissioned Hershey's to make a chocolate bar as a ration, but it had to be not tasty enough that you would want to eat it unless you were starving.
Right.
So,
how did they decide on that? Like, where's the benchmark for like, oh, if I have to, I'll eat it?
It basically has to be, it sits on you at all times because it doesn't melt and it doesn't go off. So it can last a long time. It's easily packaged. It's a very dense, calorific survival food.
Oh, I see.
Like a like a space foodie
vibe. So yeah, if you haven't eaten for 3 days, that's the only time they want you to even consider opening it and trying it.
Yeah.
So they had to make it basically disgusting.
Ooh.
The troops joked it was Hitler's secret weapon because people would, you know, you'd be tempted. It worked very successfully. The GIs refused to eat it unless they're absolutely starving. But yeah, it's a weird concept to imagine like designing a chocolate bar that has all the nutrition and the and the calories that make it a good thing to snack on, but deliberately making it disgusting.
Yeah.
So there's actually another reason that American chocolate tastes bad to non-Americans. Have you ever noticed when you're eating American chocolate, there's a kind of weird, sicky aftertaste and the aroma? I don't know. Maybe it's just
me. Yeah, I have noticed that generally with American things.
There goes our American audience. 17% of our listens. Not just because it's got a lower cocoa content. It's also because America's a large country, which means the supply chains are a little bit longer. So all the chocolate and the cocoa and the sugar and the milk solids, they sit on trains and planes and lorries for a bit longer, which means they have to add a preservative called butyric acid, which isn't present in such high quantities in the UK and Europe. And butyric acid is the thing that gives rancid butter its taste and is also present in vomit, which is why when you eat American chocolate and you're not used to it, it does taste a little bit icky.
Wow.
It is gross. Sorry, guys. Sorry for you.
I know. But then they get it the other way. If they come to Europe and they taste our chocolate, it's like chocolate on steroids. It's chocolate plus.
Yeah, mm. That's good for them.
Yeah.
But yeah. They're having a great time.
Yeah, don't feel sorry for them is what I'm saying.
For our second lunchbox today, it's me.
Ooh.
Mm.
And, well, guys, ooh, I have brought some lovely chocolates.
I'm so happy right now.
I must confess, I did not make these myself.
What?
I'm not a professional chocolatier. But this chocolate box, I'm going to call it my chocolate box,
mm-hmm.
reminds me of a certain moment in pop culture, which you, I hope, are familiar with. And I'm going to give you a clue, me doing an impression of eating
strapping, guys.
The chocolate. Okay, are you ready? Mm-hmm. I'll just take one.
Much too good for children.
Do you know which I'm referring?
No.
I think it's from Matilda, right?
Yeah.
It's from Matilda.
God, I haven't seen that film in years.
The Danny DeVito film.
Oh, yeah.
An iconic children's movie.
Mm.
I loved that film growing up. And the villain in the film and in the book, Roald Dahl's famous book, Matilda, is a woman called Miss Trunchbull.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And she has a box of chocolates that has sort of her favorite thing, her treat, and Matilda goes and steals one. Yeah. But there's actually a lot of chocolate in this film.
Yeah, there is.
Which we will get on to talk about. But the first thing I want to talk about is, like, why haven't I made these chocolates? Even though I'm, you know, a trained chef, why is it too difficult to make chocolates like this? Unsurprisingly, given all the information that we've already discovered about chocolate today, chocolate is actually bloody annoying and hard to work with.
Yeah,
it's actually a little fiend in the kitchen. You know, bars of chocolate like this, they all have to go through one process and it's called tempering.
Okay.
Oh.
Generally speaking, tempering refers to any process that is temperature controlled.
Okay.
So you can refer to tempering chocolate, which is what I'm about to describe, but you can also refer to tempering eggs, for example. That's quite a common example where, you know, you might add a little bit of a hot thing to some eggs to gently warm them up so that when they meet the rest of the hot thing that they're going into, let's say it's a custard, it's a carbonara even, they are not shocked by the temperature change. They've had time for their gentle unfurling of the proteins. So you can just simply melt chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
It will potentially, though, change in its texture when it then solidifies again. When
it does,
you might notice that it becomes dull, as in not shiny.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It will become a bit soft, so as in we won't have a good snap.
Mm.
Potentially shrieky.
Oh my god!
And potentially streaky or covered in a sort of white bloom. It's described as the bloom is the cocoa butter rising to the surface. There are definitely instances when you don't need to temper chocolate, like for example when you're making brownies. Basically whenever chocolate, melted chocolate, is going into an emulsion or a mix, you don't need to temper
it. Have to look
it doesn't have to be it's going, there's too much going on. But when you want your chocolate to be absolutely perfect at the end, for example to make a lovely chocolate like this, you do need to temper it. So the basic process is you melt the chocolate, you heat it to a certain temperature, and those temperatures vary depending on what type of chocolate you are tempering. You cool the chocolate, and there's three methods you can do this, generally speaking. Either you spread it over a marble surface, which you might have seen on like Lindt adverts and stuff.
Does it have to be marble?
Marble is really conductive, so it absorbs heat really well.
Mm.
And so if you're looking to sort of control temperature, for example, with chocolate, it's quite a useful tool almost in that process. So you can spread it over marble, you can use an ice bowl, or you can add more cold tempered chocolate chips to your melted chocolate. That's called seeding. Then once you've cooled it back down, you have to melt it again, heat it back up again. It's a three-step process, basically.
It's like the Wim Hof method for chocolate.
Yeah, it's really annoying. Essentially, when you temper the chocolate, you rearrange the cocoa butter crystals in order to give it this smooth and glossy finish when it then solidifies. Mm. And when you melt chocolate traditionally, like when you melt chocolate the normal way, the sort of boring standard, you and me and everyone else just popping it in the microwave way.
My Morris dancing outfit.
The cocoa butter can separate and go into the wrong arrangement, basically.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so back to Trunchbull and her chocolates. Matilda actually has another chocolate scene, which you might be familiar with.
I think I'm more familiar with this one.
Yeah.
Is this the cake one?
Bruce Bogtrotter's cake.
That one I remember.
So poor old Bruce Bogtrotter, a little kid in the movie who goes to Matilda's school, is forced by Miss Trashball to eat an absolutely vast chocolate fudge cake by himself.
Sorry, this is punishment because he stole a slice, was it?
He stole a slice, yeah. Mm. That scene took 3 weeks to film.
No way.
Yeah. So I, as you may know, I have a history of working in food television and advertising as a food stylist. So this kind of angle with things really interests me. And I think it's a very like, it's one of the things when you're a kid that you get so entranced by chocolate watching it in all these movies.
Yeah,
absolutely. Matilda or Charlie in the Chocolate Factory. Mm. So yeah, that scene took 3 weeks to film. And every day they had to repaint all the chocolate onto his shirt and stuff. And they had to make,
to get it
so many cakes, hundreds of cakes. You need to film him eating, but you're only ever going to see him eating like sections at a time and then they cut. So you don't need to have a whole fresh cake every time, but you do need to have a lot of fresh cake. Mm-hmm. I actually know the food stylist who worked on the most recent Matilda film. Mm. It took 8 weeks altogether and 200 cakes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What? That's crazy.
What happens to the leftovers?
It's a very big question in film and television. Yeah. There is an element of trying to avoid waste and people will give food to the crew as much as possible. But there's also food hygiene, you know.
And your child actor's like put his hands into the cake and smeared it all over his face.
Wow. Yeah. They nearly cut the scene in the DeVito film because it was taking too long and it isn't really a plot point. Like it doesn't really move the plot forward.
I guess it just makes Trunchbull a bit more evil, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's colour, it's character.
And it's the most, I was going to say, the most memorable scene in the film. That and her swinging a small child around. Like, those are the two things.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently that on the call sheet of the movie, they had an infinity symbol written next to that scene because it was taking them so long to film.
Wow. And why, sorry, do you know why it took so long to film?
Mm. I imagine that because of continuity with food is really hard, right? Mm. You have to recreate a plate every single time or a crumb on someone's face. It takes a long time to get that. And also getting the cake looking exactly the same every single time. And there are very expert food stylists and chefs who work on these shows and films that spend all of their time. And it's not the kind of cooking that you might think it is. It's not like sexy cooking that we might do at home or that you see on Instagram. This is precision and it's really quite like ruthless. This is not for eating. Anyway, I just thought that was just so interesting and I loved that. I love that cake. And Pizza Express, bring back your chocolate cake because it really reminded me of that. Our final lunchbox today is from my sweet Manu.
Ooh. I've always wanted an excuse to buy these. I have brought Japanese Kit Kats.
Oh, I wonder which flavour you bought.
We've got milk tea flavoured Kit Kat.
Oh, oh wow. God. They're sort of tartan design, don't they?
It's very UK coded.
It's got a teapot with a crown on.
Let's crack in. Ooh.
Oh, wow. Definitely tastes like tea from a tea urn.
It tastes like lemony Earl Grey.
Mm. So today I wanted to talk about Japan's very, very special relationship with Kit Kats, but also with just chocolate in general. So Kit Kats were introduced to Japan in 73. The original company was founded in the 1930s by a British Quaker philanthropist called Joseph Rowntree. Mm. And then Nestle bought it in 88.
Rowntree off of Rowntree's fruit pastels.
Exactly. Yes. So that's the same. Apparently he's a really nice dude.
Yeah, another sort of like pioneer of workers' rights and making sure your workers were well paid, well fed, and they had their families. I'm sure he invented another town, just like Bourneville and Cadbury. Mm. They were all the same sort of...
So, like I said, Kit Kats were brought over in the 70s. Today, there have been over 300 special edition flavours of Kit Kats.
Wow, 300?
300.
I'm not sure I could think of 300 flavours.
You can probably name one and they'd have done it.
Blueberry.
Most definitely. One of the most famous ones is matcha green tea. I chose the white tea version.
I've actually tried that one.
It's really nice, isn't it? They've also done wasabi, soy sauce, sweet potato, roasted corn, loads of mad flavors.
I love the attitude in Japan. They have this real thing of like, why wouldn't we try that? Like, we should. Whereas a lot of other countries just don't bother. They're just like, no, let's give soy sauce Kit Kat a go. And it's probably delicious.
They like to innovate, don't they?
Yeah. They do like to innovate.
Well, it's also because chocolate came to Japan quite late. So it arrived like before kind of early 20th century, but it didn't really take off until after the war and loads of Americans started bringing it over.
Okay.
So like they don't have the same kind of associations that we have in the West with like chocolate is... brown. No, you know what I mean? Like we have classic flavors. I think they're a lot more inventive with it. The cool thing about Kit Kats in Japan, the reason why they got so big over there, it was basically like the biggest stroke of marketing luck. So Kit Kat realized that their sales were like booming in January and they're like, what is going on? And it turned out that people were buying them for students sitting their university entrance exams.
Okay.
Because Kit Kat sounds a lot like the Japanese phrase Kito Katsu, which means you will surely win. They turned Kit Kats into like a good luck token.
Oh, wow.
That's a lovely little
thing. Really cool. So they made like a postcard version of a Kit Kat. So a Kit Kat with space on the packaging where you could write a little message, put an address.
Sweet.
Yeah, pop it in the post. It's really sweet.
I want one so badly.
I know.
Also a good example of the importance of understanding the culture of the place you're opening a market in.
Exactly. So yeah, Kit Kats in Japan, they go mad for them. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the Japanese Valentine's chocolate.
Okay.
Which is so fun and a little bit controversial. So on Valentine's Day, it's traditional for women to do the gifting of chocolate.
Okay.
But there's a specific way they do it. It's called obligation chocolate or giri chocolate. And it's
way to be romantic about it.
Oh, because it's not for romantic partners.
Oh.
It's for men you work with.
What?
It's so interesting. So it's like Valentine's Day, for some reason, has become this occasion in which you not only show affection for people that you love, but also like women are supposed to kind of pick their favorite men at work and be like, you deserve some chocolate. You're doing a great job.
Hang on, Manny. You and I work together and I've never received obligation chocolate from you. Are you telling me I'm not your favorite male in the office?
Clearly not.
I'm very bruised by that.
But sorry, can I ask? Maybe you're getting to this.
Yeah.
Do women get anything?
Oh, well, not on Valentine's Day traditionally. They have their own day, which is on the 14th of March, which is called White Day, which is where they get their gifts. And it's basically anything white and sweet. So it can be chocolate, it can be marshmallows, but that's the day where they're kind of given their bit of attention.
Right, okay.
Unsurprisingly, a lot of these traditions, because chocolate is so new there, were kind of invented essentially by chocolate companies.
Marketing,
Some chocolatiers do 70% of their business on Valentine's Day.
Wow.
It's mad.
To women?
Just to people in general, but especially to women.
Obligation chocolate.
Exactly. Yeah. There are other ways of gifting chocolate on Valentine's Day, apart from the obligation chocolate. So there's Honmei Choco, which is true feelings or favorite chocolate, which is the chocolate you give to the person you actually fancy or have a crush on.
Okay.
There's Tomo Choco, which is friend chocolate. Kazoku Choco, which is for your family.
Oh. May I ask, are they all different types of chocolate? How do you distinguish without writing... You are a person I think is fine. Like
I think it's implicit in the who's gifting it.
I suppose it's a bit like Christmas, right? Where you give lots of people presents and those relationships are already established. Like you know what that present is for. Okay. It's not a sexy romantic present when you give your great aunt Deirdre a new tea towel.
Speak for yourself.
But yeah, there are obviously debates around giri chocolate, obligation chocolate, because no one really wants to be forced to give a present.
Yeah, I think any forced present giving is just defeats the whole point of a present.
So there's quite a lot of companies in Japan that are banning the practice now. But one really interesting argument for, I found, was in 96, a female sociologist called Ogasawa Yuko said it was one of the only ways in which female employees had power over their male colleagues because they could show favoritism in a way that wasn't really like an option before. Yeah. But yeah, it's not so popular now. One of the things I love is it happens across a few Asian countries, like the Valentine's Day, the White Day. In South Korea, they have Black Day, which is when single people who haven't received anything on either of these celebration days wear black clothes and eat comfort food.
That was my 20s.
Black decade.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
That's right. And you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes, questions, feedback by emailing us at lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any favourite chocolate recipes for us?
Yes, I do. Did you ever have like chocolate sponge with chocolate custard when you were at school?
Oh.
It was one of my fave hot puddings that they made at my school. Anyway, I've developed a sort of grown-up version of it. Cool. It's on my Instagram, at Rosie McKean Pasta Queen, or on my Substack newsletter, The Dinner Party.
Amazing.
And we'll leave you with this concerning statistic from a 2017 survey commissioned by the Innovation Center for US Dairy, which found that 7% of American adults, that's 16.4 million people, believe that chocolate milk comes from brown cows.
Oh, no.
Wow.
We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Orio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee, and it was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.